3. The rise of the radical right after the First World War was undoubtedly a response to the danger, indeed to the reality, of social revolution and working class power in general, to the October Revolution and Leninism in particular. Without these, there would have been no fascism, for though the demagogic right-wing ultras had been politically vocal and aggressive in a number of European countries since the end of the 19th century, they had almost invariably been kept well under control before 1914. To this extent, apologists for fascism are probably right in holding that Lenin engendered Mussolini and Hitler. However, it is entirely illegitimate to exculpate fascist barbarism by claiming that it was inspired by or imitated the allegedly earlier barbarities of the Russian Revolution, as some German historians came close to doing in the 1980s. However, two important qualifications must be made to the thesis that the right backlash was essentially a response to the revolutionary left. First, it underestimates the impact of the First World War on an important stratum of largely middle and lower middle class nationalist soldiers or young men who, after November 1918, resented their missed chance of heroism. The so-called frontline soldier, Frontsoldat, was to play a most important part in the mythology of radical right movements. Hitler was one himself, and it was to provide a substantial block of the first ultra-nationalist strong-arm squads, such as the officers who murdered the German communist leaders Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg in early 1919, the Italian Squadristi and German Freikorps. 57% of the early Italian fascists were ex-servicemen. As we have seen, the First World War was a machine for brutalizing the world, and these men gloried in the release of their latent brutality. The strong commitment of the left, from the liberals onwards, to anti-war and anti-militarist movements, the huge popular revulsion against the mass killing of the First World War, led many to underestimate the emergence of a relatively small but absolutely numerous minority for whom the experience of fighting, even under the conditions of 1914-1918, was central and inspirational, for whom uniform and discipline, sacrifice of self and others, and blood, arms and power were what made masculine life worth living. They did not write many books about the war, though, especially in Germany, one or two did. These Rambos of their time were natural recruits for the radical right. The second qualification is that the right-wing backlash responded not against Bolshevism as such, but against all movements, and notably the organized working class, which threatened the existing order of society or could be blamed for its breakdown. Lenin was the symbol of this threat rather than the actual reality, which for most politicians was represented not so much by the socialist labor parties, whose leaders were moderate enough, but by the upsurge of working class power, confidence and radicalism, which gave the old socialist parties a new political force and in fact made them the indispensable props of liberal states. It is no accident that in the immediate post-war years, the central demand of socialist agitators since 1889 was conceded almost everywhere in Europe, the eight-hour day. It was the threat implicit in the rise of Labour's power which froze the blood of conservatives, rather than the mere transformation of Labour union leaders and opposition orators into government ministers, though this was bitter enough. They belonged by definition to the left. In an era of social upheaval, no clear line divided them from the Bolsheviks. Indeed, many of the socialist parties would have happily joined the communists in the immediate post-war years had these not rejected their affiliation. The man whom Mussolini had assassinated after his march on Rome was not a CP leader, but the socialist Matteotti. The traditional right may have seen godless Russia as the embodiment of all that was evil in the world, but the rising of the generals in 1936 was not directed against the communists, as such if only because these were the smallest part of the popular front. It was directed against a popular upsurge which, until the Civil War, favoured socialists and anarchists. It is an ex post facto rationalisation which makes Lenin and Stalin the excuse for fascism. And yet, what must be explained is why the right-wing backlash after the First World War won its crucial victories in the form of fascism. For extremist movements of the ultra-right had existed before 1914, hysterically nationalist and xenophobic, idealizing war and violence, intolerant and given to strong-arm coercion, passionately anti-liberal, anti-democratic, anti-proletarian, anti-socialist and anti-rationalist, dreaming of blood and soil and a return to the values which modernity was disrupting. They had some political influence within the political right and in some intellectual circles, but nowhere did they dominate or control. What gave them their chance after the First World War was the collapse of the old regimes and, with them, of the old ruling classes and their machinery of power, influence and hegemony. Where these remained in good working order, there was no need for fascism. It made no progress in Britain, in spite of the brief flurry of nerves noted above. The traditional conservative right remained in control. It made no effective progress in France until after the defeat of 1940, though the traditional French radical right, the monarchist Action Française and Colonel Laroque's Croix de Feu, Fiery Cross, were ready enough to beat up leftists, it was not strictly fascist. Indeed, some elements of it would even join the resistance. Again, fascism was not needed where a new nationalist ruling class or group could take over in newly independent countries. These men could be reactionary and might well opt for authoritarian government for reasons to be considered below, but it was rhetoric that identified every turn to the anti-democratic right in Europe between the wars with fascism. There were no fascist movements of importance in the new Poland, which was run by authoritarian militarists, and in the Czech part of Czechoslovakia, which was democratic, nor in the dominant Serbian core of the new Yugoslavia. Where significant fascist or similar movements existed, in countries whose rulers were old-fashioned right-wingers or reactionaries, in Hungary, Romania, Finland, even in Franco-Spain, whose leader was not himself a fascist, they had little trouble in keeping them under control, unless, as in Hungary in 1944, the Germans put the screw on them. This does not mean that minority nationalist movements in old or new states might not find fascism attractive, if only because they could expect financial and political support from Italy and, after 1933, from Germany. This was clearly so in Belgium, Flanders, in Slovakia and in Croatia. The optimal conditions for the triumph of the crazy ultra-right were an old state and its ruling mechanisms which could no longer function. A mass of disenchanted, disoriented, and discontented citizens who no longer knew where their loyalties lay, strong socialist movements threatening or appearing to threaten social revolution but not actually in a position to achieve it, and a move of nationalist resentment against the peace treaties of 1918-1920. These were the conditions in which helpless old ruling elites were tempted to have recourse to the ultra-radicals, as the Italian liberals did to Mussolini's fascists in 1920 to 1922, and as the German conservatives did to Hitler's National Socialists in 1932 to 1933. These, by the same token, were the conditions that turned movements of the radical right into powerful organized and sometimes uniformed and paramilitary forces, squadristi, stormtroopers, or, as in Germany during the Great Slump, into massive electoral armies. However, in neither of the two fascist states did fascism conquer power, though in both Italy and Germany it made much of the rhetoric of capturing the street and marching on Rome. In both cases, fascism came to power by the connivance of, indeed, as in Italy, on the initiative of, the old regime, that is to say, in a constitutional fashion. The novelty of fascism was that once in power, it refused to play the old political games and took over completely where it could. The total transfer of power, or the elimination of all rivals, took rather longer in Italy, 1922 to 1928, than in Germany, 1933 to 1934. But once it was achieved, there were no further internal political limits on what became, characteristically, the untrammeled dictatorship of a supreme populist leader, Duce. Führer. At this point, we must briefly dismiss two equally inadequate theses about fascism, the one fascist, but taken over by many liberal historians, the other dear to orthodox Soviet Marxism. There was no fascist revolution, and neither was fascism the expression of monopoly capitalism or big business. Fascist movements had the elements of revolutionary movements inasmuch as they contained people who wanted a fundamental transformation of society, often with a notably anti-capitalist and anti-oligarchic edge. However, the horse of revolutionary fascism failed either to start or to run. Hitler rapidly eliminated those who took the socialist component in the name of the National Socialist German Workers' Party seriously, as he certainly did not. the utopia of a return to some kind of little man's Middle Ages, full of hereditary peasant proprietors, artisan craftsmen like Hans Sachs, and girls in blonde plaits, was not a programme that could be realised in major 20th century states, except in the nightmare version of Himmler's plans for a racially purified people, least of all in regimes which, like Italian and German fascism, were committed in their way to modernization and technological advance. What National Socialism certainly achieved was a radical purging of the old imperial elites and institutional structures. After all, the only group which actually launched a revolt against Hitler and was consequently decimated was the old aristocratic Prussian army in July 1944. This destruction of the old elites and the old frameworks, reinforced after the war by the policies of the occupying Western armies, was eventually to make it possible to build the Federal Republic on a much sounder basis than the Weimar Republic of 1918 to 1933, which had been little more than the defeated empire minus the Kaiser. Nazism certainly had, and partly achieved, a social program for the masses. Holidays, sports, the planned people's car, which the world came to know after the Second World War as the Volkswagen Beetle. Its chief achievement, however, was to liquidate the great slump more effectively than any other government, for the anti-liberalism of the Nazis had the positive side that it did not commit them to an a priori belief in the free market. Nevertheless, Nazism was a revamped and revitalized old regime rather than a basically new and different one. Like the imperial and militarist Japan of the 1930s, which nobody would claim to have been a revolutionary system, it was a non-liberal capitalist economy which achieved a striking dynamization of its industrial system. The economic and other achievements of fascist Italy were considerably less impressive, as was demonstrated in the Second World War. Its war economy was unusually feeble. Talk of a fascist revolution was rhetoric, though no doubt for many Italian rank-and-file fascists, sincere rhetoric. It was much more openly a regime in the interests of the old ruling classes, having come into existence as a defence against post-1918 revolutionary unrest, rather than, like in Germany, as a reaction to the traumas of the Great Slump and the inability of Weimar governments to cope with them. Italian fascism, which in one sense carried on the process of Italian unification from the 19th century, thus producing a stronger and more centralised government, had some significant achievements to its credit. It was, for instance, the only Italian regime successfully to suppress the Sicilian Mafia and the Neapolitan Camorra. Yet its historical significance lay not in its aims and achievements, but in its role as the global pioneer of a new version of the triumphant counter-revolution. Mussolini inspired Hitler, and Hitler never failed to acknowledge Italian inspiration and priority. On the other hand, Italian fascism was, and for a long time remained, an anomaly among radical right-wing movements in its toleration of, even a certain taste for, artistic avant-garde modernism, and in some other respects, notably, until Mussolini fell into line with Germany in 1938, a complete lack of interest in anti-Semitic racism. As for the monopoly capitalist thesis, the point about really big business is that it can come to terms with any regime that does not actually expropriate it, and any regime must come to terms with it. Fascism was no more the expression of the interests of monopoly capital than the American New Deal or British Labour governments or the Weimar Republic. Big business in the early 1930s did not particularly want Hitler and would have preferred more orthodox conservatism. It gave him little support until the Great Slump, and even then support was late and patchy. However, when he came to power, business collaborated wholeheartedly, up to the point of using slave labour and extermination camp labour for its operations during the Second World War. Large and small business, of course, benefited from the expropriation of the Jews. It must nevertheless be said that fascism had some major advantages for business over other regimes. First, it eliminated or defeated left-wing social revolution, and indeed seemed to be the main bulwark against it. Second, it eliminated labour unions and other limitations on the rights of management to manage its workforce. Indeed, the fascist leadership principle was what most bosses and business executives applied to their subordinates in their own businesses, and fascism gave it authoritative justification. Third, the destruction of labour movements helped to secure an unduly favourable solution of the depression for business. Whereas in the USA, the top 5% of consuming units between 1929 and 1941 saw their share of total national income fall by 20%, there was a similar but more modest egalitarian trend in Britain and Scandinavia. In Germany, the top 5% gained 15% during the comparable period. Finally, as already noted, fascism was good at dynamizing and modernizing industrial economies, although actually not as good at adventurous and long-term techno-scientific planning as the Western democracies. 4. Would fascism have become very significant in world history but for the Great Slump? Probably not. Italy alone was not a promising base from which to shake the world. In the 1920s, no other European movement of radical right counter-revolution looked as though it had much of a future, for much the same reason as insurrectionary attempts at communist social revolution failed. The post-1917 revolutionary wave had ebbed, and the economy seemed to recover. In Germany, the pillars of imperial society, generals, civil servants and the rest, had indeed given some backing to the freelance paramilitaries and other wild men of the right after the November Revolution, though understandably putting their main effort in keeping the new republic conservative, anti-revolutionary and, above all, a state capable of maintaining some international room for manoeuvre. However, when forced to choose, as during the right-wing Kapp Putsch of 1920 and the Munich Revolt of 1923, in which Adolf Hitler first found himself in the headlines, they unhesitatingly backed the status quo. After the economic upturn of 1924, the National Socialist Workers' Party was reduced to a rump of 2.5 to 3% of the electorate, scoring little more than half of even the small and civilized German Democratic Party, little more than a fifth of the communists and well under a tenth of the social democrats in the elections of 1928. Yet 2 years later, it had risen to over 18% of the electorate, the second strongest party in German politics. 4 years later, in the summer of 1932, it was by far the strongest, with over 37% of the total vote, though it did not maintain this support while democratic elections lasted. It was patently the Great Slump which turned Hitler from a phenomenon of the political fringe into the potential and eventually the actual master of the country. However, even the Great Slump would not have given fascism either the force or the influence it plainly exercised in the 1930s if it had not brought a movement of this kind to power in Germany, a state destined by its size, economic and military potential, and not least geographical position, to play a major political role in Europe under any form of government. Utter defeat in two world wars has, after all, not prevented Germany from ending the 20th century as the dominant state on that continent. Just as, on the left, the victory of Marx in the latest State of the Globe, 1/6 of the world's land surface, as communists like to boast between the wars, gave communism a major international presence, even at times when its political force outside the USSR was negligible, so the capture of Germany by Hitler appeared to confirm the success of Mussolini's Italy and to turn fascism into a powerful global political current. The successful policy of aggressive militarist expansionism by both states, reinforced by that of Japan, dominated the international politics of the decade. It was therefore natural that suitable states or movements should be attracted and influenced by fascism, should seek the support of Germany and Italy, and, given these countries' expansionism, should often receive it. In Europe, for obvious reasons, such movements belonged overwhelmingly to the political right. Thus, within Zionism, which at this time was overwhelmingly a movement of Ashkenazic Jews living in Europe, that wing of the movement which looked towards Italian fascism, Vladimir Jabotinsky's revisionists, were clearly seen and classified themselves on the right against the predominant socialist and liberal Zionist bodies. Yet the influence of fascism in the 1930s could not but be to some extent global, if only because it was associated with two dynamic and active powers. Yet outside Europe, the conditions which created fascist movements in the home continent hardly existed. Hence, where fascist or plainly fascist-influenced movements emerged, their political location and function was far more problematic. Of course, certain characteristics of European fascism found an echo overseas. It would have been surprising if the Mufti of Jerusalem and other Arabs resisting Jewish colonization in Palestine and the British who protected it had not found Hitler's anti-Semitism to their liking, though it bore no relation to the traditional modes of Islamic coexistence with unbelievers of various kinds. Some upper caste Hindus in India were, like modern Sinhalese extremists in Sri Lanka, conscious of their superiority, as certified, indeed as the original Aryans, to darker races on their own subcontinent. And the Boer militants, who were interned as pro-Germans during the Second World War, some became their country's leaders in the era of apartheid after 1948, also had ideological affinities with Hitler, both as convinced racists and through the theological influence of elitist ultra-right-wing Calvinist currents in the Netherlands. Yet this hardly qualifies the basic proposition that fascism, unlike communism, was non-existent in Asia and Africa, except perhaps among some local European settlers, because it appeared to have no bearing on the local political situations. This is broadly true even of Japan, though that country was allied to Germany and Italy, fought on the same side in the Second World War, and its politics were dominated by the right. The affinities between the dominant ideologies of the eastern and western ends of the Axis are indeed strong. The Japanese were second to none in their conviction of racial superiority and the need for racial purity, in their belief in the military virtues of self-sacrifice, absolute obedience to orders, self-abnegation and stoicism. Every samurai would have subscribed to the motto of Hitler's SS, Meine Ehre ist Treue, best translated as honour means blind subordination. Theirs was a society of rigid hierarchy, of the total dedication of the individual, if such a term had any local meaning in the Western sense at all, to the nation and its divine emperor, and the utter rejection of liberty, equality, and fraternity. The Japanese had no trouble in understanding the Wagnerian brand of myths about barbarian gods, pure and heroic medieval knights, and the specifically German nature of mountain and forest, both filled with German Völkisch dreams. They had the same capacity to combine barbaric behaviour with a sophisticated aesthetic sensibility, the concentration camp torturers' taste for playing Schubert quartets. Insofar as fascism could have been translated into Zen terms, the Japanese might well have welcomed it, though they had no need of it. And indeed, among the diplomats accredited to the European fascist powers, but especially among the ultra-nationalist terror groups given to assassinating insufficiently patriotic politicians, and in the Kwantung Army, which was conquering, holding and enslaving Manchuria and China, there were Japanese who recognised these affinities and campaigned for closer identification with the European fascist powers. Yet European fascism could not be reduced to an Oriental feudalism with an imperial national mission. It belonged essentially to the era of democracy and the common man, while the very concept of a movement of mass mobilisation for novel, indeed for would-be revolutionary purposes, behind self-selected leaders made no sense in Hirohito's Japan. The Prussian army and tradition, rather than Hitler, fitted their view of the world. In short, despite the similarities with German National Socialism, the affinities with Italy were far less, Japan was not fascist. As for the states and movements which looked for support from Germany and Italy, especially during the Second World War, when the Axis looked very much like winning, ideology was not their major motive, though some of the minor nationalist regimes in Europe, whose position depended entirely on German backing, readily advertised themselves as more Nazi than the SS, notably the Croatian Ustashi state. Yet it would be absurd to think of the Irish Republican Army or the Berlin-based Indian nationalists as in any sense fascist, because in the Second World War, as in the First, some of them negotiated for German support on the principle that my enemy's enemy is my friend. Indeed, the Irish Republican leader Frank Ryan, who entered such negotiations, was ideologically so anti-fascist that he had actually joined the International Brigades to fight General Franco in the Spanish Civil War before being captured by Franco's forces and sent to Germany. Such cases need not detain us. However, there remains a continent on which the ideological impact of European fascism is undeniable: the Americas. In North America, men and movements inspired by Europe were not of great significance outside particular immigrant communities whose members brought the ideologies of the old country with them, as the Scandinavians and Jews had brought a proclivity towards socialism, or who retained some loyalty to the country of their origin. Thus, the sentiments of Germany and, to a much smaller extent, Italian Americans contributed to US isolationism, though there is no good evidence that they became fascists in large numbers. The paraphernalia of militias, coloured shirts and arms raised in salutes to leaders did not belong to the native right-wing and racist mobilisations of which the Ku Klux Klan was the most familiar. Anti-Semitism was certainly strong, though its contemporary right-wing US version, as in Father Coughlin's popular radio sermons out of Detroit, probably owed more to the right-wing corporatism of European Catholic inspiration. It is characteristic of the USA in the 1930s that the most successful and possibly dangerous demagogic populism of the decade, Huey Long's conquest of Louisiana, came from what was, in American terms, a clearly radical and left-wing tradition. It cut down democracy in the name of democracy and appealed not to the resentments of a petty bourgeoisie or the anti-revolutionary instincts of self-preservation of the rich, but to the egalitarianism of the poor. Nor was it racist. No movement whose slogan was "Every man a king" could belong in the fascist tradition. It was in Latin America that European fascist influence was to be open and acknowledged, both on individual politicians, like Colombia's Jorge Eliezer Gaitan, 1898-1948, and Argentina's Juan Domingo Perón, 1895-1974, and on regimes like Getulio Vargas's Estado Novo, New State, of 1937-1945 in Brazil. In fact, and in spite of baseless US fears of Nazi encirclement from the South, the main effect of fascist influence in Latin America was domestic. Apart from Argentina, which clearly favoured the Axis, but did so before Perón took power in 1943 as well as after, the governments of the Western Hemisphere joined the war on the US side, at least nominally. It is, however, true that in some South American countries their military had been modelled on the German system or trained by German or even Nazi cadres. Fascist influence south of the Rio Grande is easily explained. Seen from the south, the US after 1914 no longer looked, as it had in the 19th century, like the ally of the domestic forces of progress and the diplomatic counterweight to the imperial or ex-imperial Spaniards, French and British. US imperial conquests from Spain in 1898, the Mexican Revolution, not to mention the rise of the oil and banana industries, introduced an anti-Yankee, anti-imperialism into Latin American politics, and one which the obvious taste of Washington in the first third of the century for gunboat diplomacy and landing marines did nothing to discourage. Victor Raúl Haya de la Torre, founder of the anti-imperialist APRA, American Popular Revolutionary Alliance, whose ambitions were pan-Latin American, even if APRA only established itself in his native Peru, planned to have his insurrectionaries trained by the cadres of the celebrated anti-Yankee rebel Sandino in Nicaragua. Sandino's long guerrilla war against US occupation after 1927 was to inspire the Sandinista Revolution in Nicaragua in the 1980s. Moreover, the USA of the 1930s, enfeebled by the Great Slump, did not look anything like as formidable and dominant as before. Franklin D. Roosevelt's abandonment of the gunboats and marines of his predecessors could be seen not only as a good neighbor policy, but also, mistakenly, as a sign of weakness. Latin America in the 1930s was not inclined to look north. But seen from across the Atlantic, fascism undoubtedly looked like the success story of the decade. If there was a model in the world to be imitated by up-and-coming politicians of a continent that had always taken its inspiration from the culturally hegemonic regions, such potential leaders of countries always on the lookout for the recipe to become modern, rich and great, it was surely to be found in Berlin and Rome, since London and Paris no longer provided much political inspiration and Washington was out of action. Moscow was still seen essentially as a model for social revolution, which restricted its political appeal. And yet, how different from their European models were the political activities and achievements of men who made no bones about their intellectual debt to Mussolini and Hitler. I still recall my shock at hearing the president of Revolutionary Bolivia admitting it without hesitation in a private conversation. In Bolivia, soldiers and politicians with their eye on Germany found themselves organizing the revolution of 1952, which nationalized the tin mines and gave the Indian peasantry radical land reform. In Colombia, the great People's Tribune, Jorge Elisa Gaitan, so far from choosing the political right, captured the leadership of the Liberal Party and would certainly, as president, have led it in a radical direction had he not been assassinated in Bogotá on the 9th of April 1948, an event which provoked the immediate popular insurrection of the capital, including its police, and the proclamation of revolutionary communes in many a provincial municipality of the country. What Latin American leaders took from European fascism was its deification of populist leaders with a reputation for action. But the masses they wanted to mobilize, and found themselves mobilizing, were not those who feared for what they might lose, but those who had nothing to lose. And the enemies against whom they mobilized them were not foreigners and outgroups, even though the element of anti-Semitism in Peronist or other Argentine politics is undeniable, but the oligarchy, the rich, the local ruling class. Perón found his core support in the Argentine working class and his basic political machine in something like a Labour Party built around the mass labour union movement he fostered. Getúlio Vargas in Brazil made the same discovery. It was the army that overthrew him in 1945 and again forced him into suicide in 1954. It was the urban working class, to which he had given social protection in return for political support, which mourned him as the father of his people. European fascist regimes destroyed labour movements. The Latin American leaders they inspired created them. Whatever the intellectual filiation, historically we cannot speak of the same kind of movement. 5. Yet these movements too must be seen as part of the decline and fall of liberalism in the age of catastrophe. For if the rise and triumph of fascism was the most dramatic expression of the liberal retreat, it is a mistake, even in the 1930s, to see this retreat exclusively in terms of fascism. So at the conclusion of this chapter, we must ask how it is to be explained. However, a common confusion which identifies fascism and nationalism must first be cleared away. That fascist movements tended to appeal to nationalist passions and prejudices is obvious, though the semi-fascist corporate states like Portugal and Austria, 1934 to 1938, being largely under Catholic inspiration, had to reserve their unqualified hatred for peoples and nations of another religion or godless ones. Moreover, simple nationalism was difficult for local fascist movements in countries conquered and occupied by Germany or Italy, or whose fortunes depended on the victory of those states against their own national governments. In suitable cases, Flanders, the Netherlands, Scandinavia, they could identify themselves with the Germans as part of a greater Teutonic racial group, but a more convenient stance, strongly backed by Dr. Goebbels' propaganda during the war, was paradoxically internationalist. Germany was seen as the core and only guarantee of a future European order, with the usual appeals to Charlemagne and anti-communism, a phase in the development of the European idea on which historians of the post-war European community do not much like to dwell. The non-German military units which fought under the German flag in the Second World War, mainly as part of the SS, usually stressed this transnational element. On the other hand, it ought to be equally obvious that not all nationalisms sympathized with fascism, and not only because the ambitions of Hitler and, to a lesser extent, Mussolini threatened a number of them, for example, the Poles and the Czechs. Indeed, as we shall see, in a number of countries, mobilization against fascism was to produce a patriotism of the left, especially during the war, when resistance to the Axis was conducted by national fronts or governments spanning the entire political spectrum, excluding only fascists and their collaborators. Broadly speaking, whether a local nationalism found itself on the side of fascism depended on whether it had more to gain than to lose by the advance of the Axis, and whether its hatred of communism or some other state, nationality or ethnic group, the Jews, the Serbs, was greater than its dislike of Germans or Italians. Thus, the Poles, though strongly anti-Russian and anti-Jewish, did not significantly collaborate with Nazi Germany, whereas the Lithuanians and some of the Ukrainians, occupied by the USSR from 1939 to 1941, did. Why did liberalism recede between the wars, even in states which did not accept fascism? Western radicals, socialists and communists who lived through this period were inclined to see the era of global crisis as the final agony of the capitalist system. Capitalism, they agreed, could no longer afford the luxury of ruling through parliamentary democracy and under liberal freedoms, which incidentally had provided the power base for moderate, reformist labour movements. Faced with insoluble economic problems and or an increasingly revolutionary working class, the bourgeoisie now had to fall back on force and coercion, that is to say, on something like fascism. As both capitalism and liberal democracy were to make a triumphant comeback in 1945, it is easy to forget that there was a core of truth in this view, as well as rather too much agitational rhetoric. Democratic systems do not work unless there is a basic consensus among most citizens about the acceptability of their state and social system, or at least a readiness to bargain for compromise settlements. This, in turn, is much facilitated by prosperity. In most of Europe, these conditions were simply not present between 1918 and the Second World War. Social cataclysm seemed to be impending or had happened. The fear of revolution was such that over most of Eastern and Southeastern Europe, as well as part of the Mediterranean, communist parties were barely ever allowed to emerge from illegality. The unbridgeable gap between the ideological right and even the moderate left wrecked Austrian democracy in 1930-1934, though it has flourished in that country since 1945 under exactly the same two-party system of Catholics and socialists. Spanish democracy broke under the same tensions in the 1930s. The contrast with the negotiated transition from the Franco dictatorship to a pluralist democracy in the 1970s is dramatic. What chances of stability there were in such regimes could not survive the Great Depression. The Weimar Republic fell largely because the Great Slump made it impossible to keep the tacit bargain between state, employers and organized workers which had kept it afloat. Industry and government felt they had no choice but to impose economic and social cuts, and mass unemployment did the rest. In mid-1932, National Socialists and Communists, between them, polled an absolute majority of all German votes, and the parties committed to the Republic were reduced to little more than a third. Conversely, it is undeniable that the stability of democratic regimes after the Second World War, not least that of the new German Federal Republic, rested on the economic miracles of those decades. Where governments have enough to distribute to satisfy all claimants, and most citizens' standard of life is steadily rising in any case, the temperature of democratic politics rarely rises to fever pitch. Compromise and consensus tended to prevail, and even the most impassioned believers in the overthrow of capitalism found the status quo less intolerable in practice than in theory. And even the most uncompromising champions of capitalism took social security systems and regular negotiations of wage rises and fringe benefits with labour unions for granted. Yet, as the Great Slump itself showed, this is only part of the answer. A very similar situation, the refusal of the organised workers to accept depression cuts, led to the collapse of parliamentary government and eventually to the nomination of Hitler as head of government in Germany. But in Britain, merely to a sharp shift from a Labour to a conservative national government within a stable and quite unshakable parliamentary system. The Depression did not automatically lead to the suspension or abolition of representative democracy, as is also evident from the political consequences in the USA, Roosevelt's New Deal, and Scandinavia, the triumph of social democracy. Only in Latin America, where government finances depended for the most part on the exports of one or two primary products, whose price collapsed suddenly and dramatically, did the slump produce the almost immediate and automatic fall of whatever governments were in being, mainly by military coups. It should be added that political change in the opposite direction also took place then in Chile and Colombia. At bottom, liberal politics was vulnerable because its characteristic form of government, representative democracy, was rarely a convincing way of running states, and the conditions of the age of catastrophe rarely guaranteed the conditions that made it viable, let alone effective. The first of these conditions was that it should enjoy general consent and legitimacy. Democracy itself rests on this consent, but does not create it, except that in well-established and stable democracies, the very process of regular voting has tended to give citizens, even those in the minority, a sense that the electoral process legitimizes the governments it produces. But few of the interwar democracies were well-established. Indeed, until the early 20th century, democracy had been rare outside the USA and France. Indeed, at least 10 of Europe's states after the First World War were either entirely new or so changed from their predecessors as to have no special legitimacy for their inhabitants. Even fewer democracies were stable. The politics of states in the age of catastrophe were, more often than not, the politics of crisis. The second condition was a degree of compatibility between the various components of the people, whose sovereign vote was to determine the common government. The official theory of liberal bourgeois society did not recognize the people as a set of groups, communities, and other collectivities with interests as such, although anthropologists, sociologists, and all practicing politicians did. Officially, the people, a theoretical concept rather than a real body of human beings, consisted of an assembly of self-contained individuals whose votes added up to arithmetical majorities and minorities, which translated into elected assemblies as majority governments and minority oppositions. Where democratic voting crossed the lines between the divisions of the national population, or where it was possible to conciliate or diffuse conflicts between them, democracy was viable. However, in an era of revolution and radical social tensions, class struggle translated into politics rather than class peace was the rule. Ideological and class intransigence could wreck democratic government. Moreover, the botched peace settlements after 1918 multiplied what we at the end of the 20th century know to be the fatal virus of democracy, namely the division of the body of citizens exclusively along ethnic, national or religious lines, as in ex-Yugoslavia and Northern Ireland. Three ethnic religious communities voting as blocs, as in Bosnia, two irreconcilable communities, as in Ulster, 62 political parties, each representing a tribe or clan, as in Somalia, cannot, as we know, provide the foundation for a democratic political system. But unless one of the contending groups or some outside authority is strong enough to establish non-democratic dominance, only for instability and civil war. The fall of the three multinational empires of Austria-Hungary, Russia and Turkey replaced three supranational states whose governments were neutral as between the numerous nationalities over which they ruled, with a great many more multinational states, each identified with one or at most with two or three of the ethnic communities within their borders. The third condition was that democratic governments did not have to do much governing. Parliaments had come into existence not so much to govern as to control the power of those who did, a function which is still obvious in the relations between the US Congress and the US Presidency. They were the devices designed as brakes which found themselves having to act as engines. Sovereign assemblies, elected on a restricted but expanding franchise, were of course increasingly common from the age of revolution on. But 19th century bourgeois society assumed that the bulk of its citizens' lives would take place not in the sphere of government, but in the self-regulating economy and in the world of private and unofficial associations, civil society. It sidestepped the difficulties of running governments through elected assemblies in two ways: by not expecting too much governing or even legislation from their parliaments, and by seeing that government, or rather administration, could be carried on regardless of their vagaries. As we have seen, bodies of independent, permanently appointed public officials had become an essential device for the government of modern states. A parliamentary majority was essential only where major and controversial executive decisions had to be taken or approved, and organizing or maintaining an adequate body of supporters was the major task of government leaders, since, except in the Americas, the executive in parliamentary regimes was usually not directly elected. In states with a restricted suffrage, that is to say, an electorate composed mainly of the wealthy, powerful, or influential minority, this was made easier by a common consensus of what constituted their collective interest, the national interest, not to mention the resources of patronage. The 20th century multiplied the occasions when it became essential for governments to govern. The kind of state which confined itself to providing the ground rules for business and civil society and the police, prisons and armed forces to keep internal and external danger at bay, the night watchman state of political wits, became as obsolete as the night watchmen who inspired the metaphor. The fourth condition was wealth and prosperity. The democracies of the 1920s broke under the tension of revolution and counter-revolution, Hungary, Italy, Portugal, or of national conflict, Poland, Yugoslavia, those of the 30s under the tensions of the slump. One has only to compare the political atmosphere of Weimar Germany and 1920s Austria with that of federal Germany and post-1945 Austria to be convinced. Even national conflicts were less unmanageable so long as each minority's politicians could feed at the state's common trough. That was the strength of the Agrarian Party in East Central Europe's only genuine democracy, Czechoslovakia. It offered benefits across national lines. In the 1930s, even Czechoslovakia could no longer hold together the Czechs, Slovaks, Germans, Hungarians, and Ukrainians. Under these circumstances, democracy was, more likely than not, a mechanism for formalizing divisions between irreconcilable groups. Very often, even in the best circumstances, it produced no stable basis for democratic government at all, especially when the theory of democratic representation was applied in the most rigorous versions of proportional representation. Where, in times of crisis, no parliamentary majority was available, as in Germany, as distinct from Britain, the temptation to look elsewhere was overwhelming. Even in stable democracies, the political divisions the system implies are seen by many citizens as costs rather than benefits of the system. The very rhetoric of politics advertises candidates and party as the representative of the national rather than the narrow party interest. In times of crisis, the costs of the system seemed unsustainable, its benefits uncertain. Under these circumstances, it is easy to understand that parliamentary democracy in the successor states to the old empires, as well as in most of the Mediterranean and in Latin America, was a feeble plant growing in stony soil. The strongest argument in its favour, that bad as it is better than any alternative system, is itself half-hearted. Between the wars, it only rarely sounded realistic and convincing. Even its champions spoke with muted confidence. Its retreat seemed to be inevitable, as even in the United States, serious but needlessly gloomy observers noted that it can happen here. Nobody seriously predicted or expected its post-war renaissance, still less its return, however brief, as the predominant form of government across the globe in the early 1990s. For those who looked back on the period between the wars at this time, the fall of liberal political systems seemed a brief interruption in their secular conquest of the globe. Unfortunately, as the new millennium approached, the uncertainties surrounding political democracy no longer seemed quite so remote. The world may be unhappily re-entering a period when its advantages no longer seem as obvious as they did between 1950 and 1990.